Okay, we are back. It's Wednesday morning, and Shildre Rosen is our guest this morning. We're also going to be joined in a short while by Bronwyn Williams, who, of course, is the host of a new show on The Real Network called Biz Trends. We'll find out all about that. It's a good week to talk to Bronwyn. Any week's a good week to talk to her, but this week especially, I'm going to be talking about so much that goes along with budgets, end of financial year, finance minister making speeches, all of that stuff. So it's all valuable and valid information. Okay, a couple of things I want to quickly show you, though. Here is something utterly revolting, Shildre, just to start your Wednesday properly. I don't know what's wrong with this guy. I'm not sure. There could be a lot wrong with him. He has some, I think they're wine gums.
Mm-hmm.
But watch this. This comes from a channel called Cringe something or another. And you can see why it's cringy. Have you got that clip, Flex?
Look at that. Hey guys, it's Maynard time. Butter.
All right, so just take it out to the back of the yard and shoot it in the head. Whatever the fuck that is. What is going on? I mean, do you want to try and interpret what you've just seen? Someone sent me that clip yesterday.
Hey. Disgusting.
What do we think of this?
No. I think that's the thing also, the power of social media. Eh? Either you're going to be a consumer or creator, and that's a creator right there.
Hey, guys. Minutes, Tam. And then he farts on it and like starts eating them. And I'm like, what is... Your parents must be so proud. You know, your whole family, your community, the people you live with, they must love you. They must be so impressed.
Hey, guys. Minutes, Tam.
This person must just be put down. Really, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
All right, then I've got something else for you as well. there's so much to talk about. I hate, and maybe I'll save this for Bronwyn, corporate speak. Mm-hmm. You know when people use this terminology, and we'll get to it. I'm going to save it for when Bronwyn's here, because she's probably going to have something to say about it too, not just you. The chewing noise is what gets everybody. Carl says, that chewing noise. I did the little dance. I did like the little dance, though. Put that thing down. Yeah, I don't know, hey. Wine bums, not wine gums, says Viasen. Here's something interesting. If you like celebrity playlists, I found a really cool playlist yesterday. I wish I could give credit to whoever had put it together. It was perfect for like rainy weather.
Okay.
And I found myself having a really good drive to and from wherever I was going. But the King Charles III of England, of Great Britain, Little Britain, he has put together a playlist.
What?
So, yeah, he wants you to know. It's called The King's Music. And he says that he enjoys quite a lot of music that you wouldn't expect him to enjoy. I mean, here's just a little taste of what the King apparently listens to.
Kylie Minogue came to St. James's Palace to perform this song in 2012. The song is The Locomotion, and this is music for dancing. Again, it has that infectious energy which makes it, I find, incredibly hard to sit still.
No Dirty Diana?
No. He regards that as being like really, it's music for dancing. I find it terribly difficult to sit still. And then he just, this is all you get out of him with his sausage fingers, right? Well done, King Charles. But I like that he chose Kylie Minogue. I wouldn't have expected that at all.
Yeah.
And this song is called The Locomotion. It's fantastic. You never know. I often wonder, and I remember Barack Obama was the first president of the United States to like release a playlist or a, I think he gave his like top 10 of his favorite songs for the year one year. And some of them were pretty cool. He liked Kendrick. There were a few surprises.
Yeah.
But the fact that, you know, the King listens to Kylie Minogue is just great. Kylie Minogue does have a lovely bum, says Carl DeSantis. The King is only interested in that. I don't know about that. King Charles has a Hilton College accent. No, you mean the other way around. Hilton College has a King Charles accent, because that accent would have been established long before Hilton College. But stop trying to grab them points, Tabo Pali. Chomotsu says he also likes Beyonce's Crazy in Love. I guess he can relate. can we have the name of the playlist you listen to, Gareth? Perfect weather to listen to today. No, Lee, because I'm not going to look it up just for you. Charles T. Hugh says Charles is a fucking traitor to the British people. Why? Because he likes an Australian singer? That's a hard reaction to King Charles. Sure. I don't know. Would you be interested in knowing any celebrities' playlists? Anyone who you'd care for their tastes in music?
Well, if he was still around, I would have wanted to listen to Nelson Mandela's playlist.
Really? Sure. He would listen to old shit, I'm pretty sure. Maskandi.
Voila, my favorite song.
I mean, that shame, even, you know, it's been more than 10 years, eh?
Yeah.
Since he's gone.
Yeah.
It's a long time.
It's a long, long, long time. Yeah.
I don't know. I would be interested to know about the playlists that, I don't know, politicians wouldn't be interested in them.
Yeah. I think you'd probably be surprised to hear what they're
I don't think anything about politicians would surprise me. I think they're all predictable, and they'd say popular things.
Yeah, and everyone would say the same thing.
Yeah, and they'd want everybody to think they were hugely eclectic. Yeah. And I want to know what embarrassing songs people like. Like, what song do you like that's really embarrassing? Like those people that you played before we went to the break? Like, I want to know. I want to know if there's anyone in the world who would like to hear that again. Please don't play it. Under no circumstances are you playing that again. Barack's favorite song is called It's Raining Men, Big Mike. I bet my house Jacob Zuma's playlist is fire, says Pumlani. Yeah, probably. Yeah, I think he would probably have a good playlist, because he could dance, remember? Let's not forget.
Yeah, no, he can dance.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So before we bring Bronwyn in, is there anything else that you want to like plug about your NGO that you're involved in? Tell us a little bit about that, Bubele Africa, and how people can. Is there a website? Is there social media we can follow? Yeah, how can we get involved?
Definitely, we do have a website. You can check us out on bubele.africa. And then also, of course, we are very much dependent on, we run off donations.
Donations, of course.
Yeah. So if you would like to donate, you can go onto our website. You can also check out our Instagram as well, Bubele Africa, and give us a follow there as well. Also have a lookout for all of the cleanups that we'll be hosting throughout the year, and how to get involved as well.
Awesome.
We would want people to get involved so that you can see also where your donation is going towards. We just recently redid our staff's uniforms and outfits and stuff, because being out in the sun, it's a bit, you know, hard.
Listen, cleaning filthy rivers and things. And I do think that if you're going to get involved in anything that has an environmental or conservationist bent, that this is probably the best place to start.
Yeah,
it's not glamorous work.
No.
But it needs doing, and we really should be looking after
it. It improves the environment for all of us. Like, when we cleaned the Zandspuit, we had all these ducks and fish life and bird life coming back. We've installed bat boxes and owl houses and stuff. It's the Zandspuit, it's the Bromfontein spread, the YXK that we've taken on. And for example, like Zandspuit, at first when we started cleaning it, you could at least fill two big bags. Now, because we're consistently cleaning it, you can not even fill up a little checker's bag.
Really? So people are actually looking after it now that it's clean.
True, but also at the same time, because of the donations and our team that are constantly, consistently we have to
clean.
And are
these people employed?
Yeah. So they. Okay. So we've got about 5 people now. We added first, on average, we had about 40 on rotation. This was volunteers, because we were giving a bit of food, a bit of money.
Right.
And then now we have now our full-time 5, staff of 5.
All right, so that's important, because I thought for a second there that it was a, you know, volunteer thing, and people pitch up for a cleanup, and then they do that, and then a couple of months later it'd be filthy again. But these guys are doing it all the time.
All the time, because also now that it's rainy season,
Okay. Every
time, of course, when the banks fill up, there's of course lots of trash laying on the riverbanks and so forth. lots of logs that needs to be pulled out of the river because of trees that fall into the into the river as well.
You know, the other day with all this rain and everything else, a friend of mine parked her car. She was visiting somebody, and a huge big tree fell on her car.
Oh, yeah.
Like, luckily she wasn't in it at the time.
Sure.
But can you imagine?
Right here in Johannesburg.
Imagine going out to your car. You've parked. You're just doing your thing.
Yeah.
Go outside and there's a whole tree on top of your car.
Yeah, that's crazy.
What are you going to do?
Jeez, man. What can you do?
Yeah. All right. While we are getting ready for Bronwyn, I'm very excited to talk to her this morning. It's always a good time to talk to her. But I do think that today we have an especially large smorgasbord of stuff to get to. But before that, do you want to play that clip of the anxious woman who turns out was a witch? Just take a look at this.
A question for Sylvia.
I have a really bad problem with social anxiety. I can't freak out. I can't.
You're doing pretty good now. But let me tell you where this comes from. You were accused of being a witch in a past life. You were put in a circle and you had to name two people so that supposedly you wouldn't die. Except they didn't tell you that. They just said, tell us two people. You named two people and all three of you were hung. So no wonder you have social anxiety.
Thank you.
All right. I don't follow, but the woman who was accusing that anxious girl of being, she looks like the witch. And I can't work out here, like, in a previous life, she's carrying anxiety in this life. In a previous life, she was a witch. Now she's carrying anxiety in this life for being a witch in a previous life. Sure. Very complicated.
Tough life.
You know, you got to choose your battles. And if you were a witch in your previous life, then...
be a witch in your next life too.
But leave it behind. What do you think, Sheldre? Leave it behind. You don't have to be a witch for the next life.
Maybe she was good at it.
Get over it. Well, if she was good at it, they wouldn't have gathered around and burnt her, which I think it sounds like they did. All right. So let us spend a little bit of time getting to know, and I'm sure you already do know who this person is, Bronwyn Williams, CEO of AI Tech Dragons. Sorry, that's not correct. Jesus, James, what the fuck is that? See, I'm just an idiot for reading it, though. She's a polymath. She will challenge your assumptions about the present and the future. I mean, I've had you on the show a couple of times, so I'm not going to pretend I don't know who you are. Futurist and economist, a business trends analyst, and her particular areas of expertise include fintech trends, alternative economic models, and sustainable future design. So, I mean, this is a hell of a week to talk to you. I said we've got the budget speech. We've got tax on everybody's mind.
Yes.
But I mean, the last, oh God, take your pick of how many months. Everything is evolving so fast. Everybody's using AI in business now. People are trying to develop AIs that understand AIs better than humans can. Everything is getting to that point of singularity that the first futurist that I can remember, Ray Kurzweil, was talking about years ago. It's not as if you are ever going to run out of things to talk about, Bronwyn.
No, the future is always coming. And the more of us there are, you know, the more questions remain unanswered. So, yeah.
All right. So first and foremost, I'm very glad that you now have a show with us called Biz Trends. Biz Trends TV.
Yes, working with the Biz Community.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And Biz Community are doing a great job there too. It's your go-to podcast, by the way, for the latest insights, trends, and strategies in the world of business. And Bronwyn is the host. They deep dive into market shifts, emerging technologies, the successful business practices that will help entrepreneurs and professionals stay ahead of the curve. And our other guest here, Bronwyn, he actually hosted a money show in the Cape for a little while. So he's also interested in the same things.
Most of us are interested in money, I think.
I think so. That is a definite area of overlap. Okay, so tell me how things are looking at the moment in terms of all of these trends, because you're always my go-to person when it comes to figuring out what people are going to be talking about in 6 months' time. And we know about some of the things that are going on now, but what are the hot topics for the next couple of months in your opinion?
Yeah. So trained analysts and futurists and my peers in 6 months' time are going to be talking about living intelligence, which is really the culmination of artificial intelligence with biotech. So, I mean, the sort of brain in the vat.
Neuralink stuff, huh?
Brain in the vat. So brains connected to computers. You can already buy an organic computer. It comes in like almost an aquarium and you can plug it in. And it doesn't necessarily work as fast as your transistors.
Hang on a second. Is this already the...
Yes,
This is the overlap of electronics and bioelectronics.
Yes. So that's why we call it living intelligence. So it's not artificial intelligence, although it is created intelligence. It's actually using the natural world to try and power now artificial intelligence in one direction and also having artificial intelligence direct the natural world in the other direction. So,
what would be the advantages of this for... I mean, if you could create a machine that is able to interact with biology, that obviously is great, because who knows, you could do everything from help people regenerate damaged nerve tissue, able to walk again, be able to repair parts of the brain that may be damaged. Lots that we can do there. But in terms of actual computing power, isn't it safer to have that not in an aquarium?
Safer, yes, but when you start to look at the limits of artificial intelligence, like the things that AI can't learn are the things that come from our full bouquet of senses. So the idea is if we can literally grow brain tissue in a vat and connect that to our chips, we're able to allow the chip to learn the way that we learn as soggy meat sacks. We've got like meat sack computing power, and then of course artificial intelligence is like, you know, wires and cables technology.
Don't be disparaging about the biology, because the ultimate dream then is to also do things the opposite way, where we download our entire consciousness onto some sort of machine, and then we can live forever. True immortality.
Well, that's the idea. So what we're trying to do is make our computers more and more like us and us more and more like our computers at the same time. I mean, like the sort of the low end of that are things like smart pills or even smart sperm. They can like attach computing power to sperm to make it swim because no one's having babies anymore, you know, like that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not particularly new. I mean, we spoke about that in our transhumanism sort of stuff at around 2015, but that's kind of here now. And then also, as you say, the Neuralink thing, but also sensing more and more from our physical world, whether that be crops, whether that be our bodies, and plugging that back into computers and kind of closing that loop. So that, of course, means that on the one hand, we're trying to use our natural intelligence to power synthetic intelligence, to make it more intelligent in the way we understand intelligence. But at the same time, we can use synthetic intelligence to program our biological intelligence.
That's exciting.
So that's where it gets exciting. And also a really in the realm of the sort of science fiction is this a guidebook or a warning manual as to where we're headed next. But basically everything that the science fiction writers wrote last century we're doing now. We're doing it.
Really? God, I don't know if I'm terrified or if I'm excited.
But you'll hear more about that from people like me. However, what people like your listeners and all people will be talking about in 6 months' time are the same things we're talking about now, like as we're calling it, debt and taxes. We'll be looking at that at a micro level, in other words, you, your family, and your budgets, or whether you're looking at that at a national or international level. Debt and taxes are on pretty much everyone's minds.
They're also the things that you know you can always be sure of.
Yes.
Regardless of what happens in the world of the future, you're going to be paying taxes and you're going to have debts, and you're going to also have inevitably to deal with SARS at some point. Have you got that SARS clip? Play this for them quickly. Take a look at this. The guy sitting in the office. No? Oh my God, I sent you the clip yesterday. I need new producers. No!
Here I am!
Not that.
I heard you need a smile.
I sent it to you yesterday, last night. It's this guy sitting in the office. Anyway, you've ruined the whole fucking thing, so just leave it, James. Mm-hmm. This guy is sitting in an office and he's like, it says there, have you ever wondered, you know, why you work so hard, and if you're ever having a bad day at the office, just think about who you're doing it for. And then he leans over, he's got a framed picture, and then he reveals.
Lock up your car, put a hand in your heart, say whatever you feel, be wherever you are, we ain't angry at you, love. You're the greatest thing we've
Okay. You made me explain half of it, then you play the clip anyway.
That is brilliant.
Talk about zero comedic timing from my producers. All right, you guys just take the rest of the show off, all right? I'll just talk to Bronwyn and Sheldre. They're more interesting than you could ever be anyway.
That's a good one.
This is the reality that we're living with, though. Yeah. Most of us work for the government for at least 3 months of the year.
Well, the few of us that pay taxes.
Yeah. Well, yes.
And individuals, less so than corporations.
But, you know, there are like really simple, stupid people in this country who think everyone pays taxes because they pay VAT, which is technically true. But the majority of South Africa's tax comes from 5% personal income tax and corporate tax, yes. Right?
Well, personal income tax, our corporates don't necessarily pay as much of our fiscal budget as comparative economies. Most of our tax comes from individual taxpayers and from 5% of South Africans,
right.
Carrying 80% of the income tax bracket. So it really is coming from individuals. There's kind of an illusion that further taxing that 5% could through wealth taxes, you know, and raising that bracket.
And they've tabled some of those.
It's a good idea because clearly that's what's working. Clearly, if they are paying 80% of it, why not 90? You know, like
just keep milking those cows until eventually they have no milk left.
But there's kind of a good argument to be made that perhaps we could be getting more from our private sector in terms of corporations, given the distribution of our economy. Mm-hmm. And of course, the difference between corporate and personal income tax rates is interesting.
Well, it's interesting. And I think it's a little bit predatory. I mean, I consider that the people who are paying income tax, the vast majority of those people, that 5% that you speak about, are taxed a number of times on that money.
Yes.
It's not as if it gets taxed once and then you don't have to worry again. There are often death duties. There are often capital gains along the way. So you, for example, will buy a property, and I don't need to explain this to my audience, I hope. You'll buy a property with your money that you've already paid tax on.
Yeah.
Right. And then when you sell that property, they'll come and say, well, we want our piece of the pie. And you'll go, but you didn't do anything for it. They'll go, ha-ha, capital gains tax time. So you have to then hand over some more of that money. And basically, they will find through stealth taxes a whole lot of other ways of getting your money into their greasy, dirty, filthy hands. Yeah. So this is what Enoch Godongwana, our Minister of Finance, is wrestling with at the moment, because he has to go to today or tomorrow. I think it should be tomorrow. And then present his budget, which includes his plans for bringing in money, not just for spending. Of course, he'll spend a bit of time on spending, but I doubt they're going to bring that down.
No, we're between a rock and a hard place there. Where are we going to cut spending in our country? You can't not pay back the debt to your foreign creditors.
Yeah.
According to most governments, not really an option. Mainly because if you don't pay that back, you can't borrow more.
Yeah. And
that's
we
the real
to,
thing.
We
and we have
need
to borrow
more
because we don't have enough tax. So you have to pay back that money. That's the largest item on our budget, by the way. Paying back debts at an interest rate higher than our economy is growing. So that's not great, but that's not avoidable. What are we going to do? Cut back on public sector wage bills or grants? I don't think so. There's an expectation set that both grant recipients and public sector wage bill should increase at a higher level than CPI. Incidentally, so does the Reserve Bank. That's a lovely little chart to look at.
Okay.
Where the Reserve Bank sets an inflation target and pays themselves an increase slightly higher than that. That's how you know.
But when you talk about the public service wage bill, this is a major thing in South Africa, because there's this unbelievable collusion between the unions who represent public workers, KASATU primarily, and then the people who are paying those workers, the government, the bureaucracy, the Ministry of Finance, the Treasury, and the people themselves, because it's this never-ending, unsustainable cycle of they want more money, the unions fight for them to get more money, automatic increases over the last 30 years, for example, and not necessarily any better work. It's not measured like the private sector, where you have shareholders and profit margins and costs that you can cut. And there's just no such thing. So there's inefficiency. I mean, wouldn't it be nice to have a doge here? Some people would think that's very controversial. But these are not things that are built into governments.
No, and of course, our state-owned enterprises are also nice, expensive toys. But again, what are we going to do? We're going to have to keep on paying for them, because we do actually want electricity, right?
But how many of them
are nice to have some?
How many of them are totally broken now? Because we've got SAA Transnet, we've got ESCOM, PRASA, SABC. I mean, we've got a lot of these things, right? These are expensive to run. They're not running them properly, the government. So we just have to keep paying?
Well, at the moment, I don't see that that's not going to come out of our budget. So we're going to have to find some money for that. And then we're also going to have to scrape together some rands and cents to pay for things like, you know, the like education.
Which is the biggest part of our budget in terms of departmental spend. Which is the biggest part
of our budget. And it's something that we really spend more on than our economic peers. Again, we spend more on our public sector wage bill proportionately to our GDP on education and on public sector wage bills by quite a lot. And as you mentioned, we don't necessarily get that return on investment, but we're not going to stop spending that money.
And,
best hope is to focus on efficiency there.
And the one that you've left out, which is big, is our social grants, which is a massive part of the expenditure that we incur as a country every month. We have to hand out some 380 rand to poor and indigent people, disabled people, people who haven't got jobs, people who need a government grant just to survive.
Yeah.
But those people amount to, I think it's somewhere around 26 million people, according to the president in his State of the Nation address at the beginning of this year.
Yeah,
26 million. And how many people are paying personal income tax again?
Not that many.
Yeah. So income, expenditure. I mean, I remember I was pretty shitty at accounting at school, but these two are not matching up.
No. So basically, you've kind of got two ways that you can fund this. And these are hungry mouths that need to be fed. These are not expenses that are going to go away. I mean, our temporary COVID relief grant is now becoming formalized. They're going to change the name, but essentially, this has now become business as usual. We effectively do have a universal basic income in this country.
Right.
Because there are basically more households or more individuals that are dependent on some form of state gratuity than not. So, I mean, like, we'd be running this experiment, and most of the world is headed that way, thanks to, as we can talk about, advances in technology and consolidation of power and wealth in other sort of parts of the world. But of course, it's not hugely sustainable from a social and political perspective, but from a budget perspective, you can't take that away once you've given that to people. People are now depending upon it. Like, we can't blame the recipient here. We've got to blame the system that's got them to a point where you've got no choice but to rely on these sorts of grants, because there are no jobs, there's no work, there's no growth to grow a business within, right? So we've got kind of a challenge there. And there's two ways you could try and fill this hole, because we're spending the money. The money is going to be spent. That money, we can't really reduce this budget. We can hope to get better quality work and quality service for what we pay for. But we certainly, that we can hope for, and maybe that could work. We can be optimists there. Mm-hmm. But we got to spend the money. You can basically get it from taking on even more debt, which, as I said, is expensive when your debt repayments are growing faster than your GDP is. You're basically paying more for less.
And at some point, you have to pay up.
Yeah. I mean, but we are paying back. We're paying the interest. This is why it's in our budget. We are paying back our debt. It's just we're paying back the debt with a larger and larger percentage of our budget. It's now the largest item on our balance sheet. Sort of what we're sitting at, like 76%. Of our GDP.
That's unbelievable.
Our debt to GDP ratio, not what we're paying.
Yeah, sure. But what countries are also like this? Because we know that many countries, America is running at a deficit. Mm. Most of Europe is to some degree. Spending more than they're bringing in.
Well, basically the whole world is spending more than it's bringing in. However, there are two types of countries. There's kinds of countries that can make this work for them. Those are rich countries, and they're ones that just get poorer and poorer, relatively speaking, which is us, which is most of the developed world. Most of the global South, certainly pretty much all of South America is in the very much the same boat. They're probably most similar to us in terms of the structure of their economy. The debt situation across the rest of the African continent is even more incredibly dire. We know what happened in Kenya with the tax protests, because that's the other thing. You either take on more debts, but if you take on more debt, you've also got to increase tax to pay back that money. It also means you have to reduce service delivery, because as debt takes up a larger chunk of your budget, you can spend less on your education, on your social grants, even on your government wage bill. Those do tend to be a bit more prioritized in our particular context. But basically, it means you, as taxpayers, as citizens, whether you're paying VAT or tax or income tax, whatever it is, you're getting less in exchange for what you are giving up. But it's a trap that you are in, and this is treadmill. And the only way to get out of it is to really grow out of it. Unless you are a strong economy like the US and to a lesser extent Europe that is able to print money to pay back your own debt. And this is a trick that only works.
It's a trick, though.
It's a trick, but it's a trick that does work if you are the strongest in the room. And it absolutely doesn't work if you are weak. Oh. If you try this in Africa, you Zimbabwe yourself. If you try this in America, you get richer. And that's because the credit economy is different to the real economy in terms of actual capital, because credit is based on reputation. And it's based not necessarily on if you like the person or the country, but it's based on if you believe they are good for the money. So if America increases its money supply, as they did in COVID, to increase service delivery, they can get away with it because we still value their dollars as they were before they increased that supply. If we try to do that with rands, and there definitely are some characters on X and Twitter that will tell you that we can modern monetary theory our way out of this. South America's tried, didn't work. Africa's tried, has not worked. America can do it, though, because if you don't accept a dollar for what it is, well, a dollar's got some other things to back up its value, and that is the world's largest military spending, right?
And it's
so
it's
the rich take what they, or the strong take what they will. The weak, that's us, suffer what we must. So we have to pay back the money. Other people can print money to pay it back. We can't do that. So we're gonna have to either grow or tax.
So Dave says here in the comments, did we bring this upon ourselves? What caused this? You know, I love people who take responsibility, but I think maybe this person is trying, it's being a bit hard on themselves. You didn't cause it, but certainly we as a country have got ourselves into this situation, mostly our government's fault.
Mostly, it's a little bit our fault too. We don't save enough as individuals.
Okay.
Because saving is money that you put into a bank or you invest in other, in fellow South Africans' businesses. So
right.
If you don't have a savings pool, there's nothing for businesses to get access to capital for, right? So to a little bit, yes, if you want to do something as an individual, save a little. I know it's hard, but if you are lucky enough to have a job, you know, and you're lucky enough to have a bit of income, try save a little bit of it because it's not just good for you, it's good for your economy.
Yeah.
Certainly a lot of this is our own government's fault. We don't exactly get return on investment or good value for a lot of the money we spend in our budget, whether we're talking about education, spending just about the most in the developing world and still having some of the most illiterate children in the developing world. We're not getting good quality products and services for what we spend. And sure, we spend too much on our public sector compared to our private sector. You know, there are a lot of own goals there too, but at a macro effect, when we start talking about the debt side of the economy, a lot of this, we're price takers and we actually don't have much choice there.
Yeah.
And we haven't had much choice since apartheid, since colonization. And I know that you might not want to get into that conversation, but a lot of this is the legacy of the dominant West from a monetary perspective, still taking effectively tribute from previous colonies due to their strength, right? So the strong keep on taking, the weak keep on losing. I think people don't always necessarily get that with our economy. We have so many of our own goals and we should focus on fixing those. We absolutely make a lot of mistakes and we could do many things better.
Of course.
But it's not all our fault. There are larger macroeconomic conditions at play too that we can only really solve if we start to work together as a continent or as a global south, right? Because you need critical mass to challenge.
Yeah, then we can actually put up a bit of a fight.
Yeah.
You were going to ask something a second ago, and if you've forgotten what it is, I wouldn't blame you because there's a lot of information flying out here. Bronwyn's great at this, helping us to figure out what the hell's going on. I'm interested in something that you said just now about how we should also save. So there is a personal responsibility part of this, which I love. And all of us should be able to do more to try and make the most of what is not the greatest economic situation, but there have been worse in our history. So how can technology and all of the information that we have at our fingertips now help us to make better decisions around our own money? Because I'm sure that everybody is trying to apply things like AI to how they manage their own business, to how they manage their expenses, to what they can shop for and what they shouldn't shop for, what they can do to save money, how things like interest rates actually work. And I don't want to get into a whole personal finance segment here because I know that's not really the wheelhouse that any of us are in. But in terms of future technology and the things that people are going to be able to access, information-wise at very least, Are there massive advantages on the way for ordinary people, for me and you, to be able to spend less, save more, look after our finances a bit more intelligently?
Well, yes and no. I mean, just take something like your AI and the ChatGPT, because I was like the first one to market. And of course, there's cheaper competitors and all the rest of it. But
which do you use, by the way?
Very little of any of them, because I've paid to make most of my money being physically present, talking to people. I'm basically a court jester, right? So, like, you know, like...
don't derogate yourself here.
It's an important position. You get to sort of talk truth to power.
But you don't use AI that much?
No, not really. I mean, we've used it a little bit for our sort of synthesis and certainly for transcribing and for getting through volumes of information. But due to the nature of my work, I can't lie to your listeners and say that I spend a lot of time using AI, because generally I'm paid to be physically present to convey information that I have in my head. That's just the nature of my job. It's not the nature of many other people's jobs. You work in more process-based positions, you're going to be using these tools. It's not like I haven't used them. It's just that they don't form into much of my particular sort of product to market, route to market that I do, right? But the point is with these tools is they are freely available. And that means they can allow you to find information that perhaps you couldn't have and to get it quicker and faster and more efficiently than you would have before. But at the same time, they are basically free and freely available to absolutely everyone. So they are first and foremost not a competitive advantage. And when you start looking at ways to make money or to beat the market, if everyone's got access to that tool, it's not actually a way to make money or to beat the market. And then you've also got to remember that that's the free level. It's accessible to everyone. But there are more powerful versions of all these technologies that are behind pay gates.
Right.
That are much more important and that are a competitive advantage to people that do access them. So the problem with trying to use technology as a way to get ahead or to hack the system is you have to be a really fast mover, or you have to have access to something that nobody else does. Because if everyone has it, all that it does is it raises the floor. And raising the floor is a good thing, but it's not going to make you relatively better off until you find a way to take that out of the system and do something unique with it in a way that can't just be cloned, digitized, copied. As we like to say, anything that can be digitized can be replicated, right? Like this is what happened with OpenAI and DeepSeek, right? I mean, like, absolutely. You think it doesn't matter how big your brand is or how much money you've got, if it can be digitized, it can be replicated.
And not only that, but then for those people to exercise a competitive advantage, they also need to have access to capital, because there's no point in knowing that you have a really great bet to place, but you don't have any money to put down on the bet.
Yes.
Right.
And we speak to this about financial services companies all the time. We're like, what can we do for our people? Like, let's do more apps. We need to increase financial inclusion. By financial inclusion, they basically mean debt, you know, like getting debt to the people.
Yeah, exactly. You know, to poor people.
That's not the point. You need to get growth to people, right? Oh. You need to get income into people's hands. And how do you get income into people's hands as ordinary South Africans? Well, there's another very simple thing you can do. Firstly, save a bit of your own money, because that money does end up supporting other businesses one way or another. Even if it's just putting it in your money market account, that money gets invested in other businesses.
Yeah, we're not going to sit here and give people financial advice either,
but
are we?
The other thing you could do is spend your money on other local businesses, right? So it's how you spend, where you spend, and who you support with your capital is where you start to actually grow your economy. So consuming is quite fun and quite nice, but whose slave are you when you are consuming? You know, who are you enriching?
Also try and become more self-sufficient, I would say. That is, like I said, I travel quite often. And every time, especially when I travel to Europe, something as simple as having to pack your own bag, you know, having to fill your own car. And when I used to work in the banking space as well, also, especially the masses wouldn't care about how much they spend when it comes to making a deposit or drawing money from the account. And even making use of intelligent means, like, for example, apps and so forth. They don't know how to use it. And I feel like if many companies and even government had to take time to start educating, especially the masses who are dependent on grants and so forth, on how to become self-sustainable, self-sufficient and so forth, they'll be able to save, because they wouldn't have to travel. And it might sound like it's not going to significantly change, but again, like coming from a banking point, if you have to count how much people can actually save just by, like, for example, using systems the right way, they'll have a bit of more money at the end of the year to be able to spend. And it's those little bits that actually adds up to a lot at the end of the day. And again, I think it will really help.
Listen, I think this is all great, but most people are just in survival mode.
Yes,
true, 100%. But then again, like you're saying also, government is also trying to figure out, like, do we give more grants? We can't keep on keeping people dependent.
The till is empty.
Yeah.
That's the reality.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And every rand we now spend or give to someone is more expensive than a rand because we're paying back debt on it, right?
So exactly.
You need to have, we need to have a positive multiplier. So basically we do need to have growth, and the ways to get growth are through saving and through spending on sorts of businesses that then will spend that money to
and so stuff. Much of it is just government getting out of the way. Like if you want to grow an economy, the last thing you actually need is a government, because people want to be able to trade with each other without all these barriers, impediments, the red tape, the bureaucracy, and people trying to get a share of rent seeking that they're not entitled to. I think so much in this country could needlessly stop suffering if we just made our labor laws a little bit less onerous and difficult for people to deal with. And we didn't talk about things like minimum wage, which are not even enforceable. I mean, in a country like this, we can't talk about minimum wage when we have illegal immigrants who will always work for less. And where there's someone who will work for less and someone who will pay that person less, that's called an economy. Mm. It's going to happen, right?
Yeah.
So these are not easy problems to solve.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, says Congo Chris, the vast masses get paid and then withdraw their entire pay.
Mm.
Saving is not in our lexicon.
Yeah.
This is probably true, right?
Yeah. It's not our lexicon, but there is really interesting research from even more impoverished countries. Like, I don't know if you know how, or how many listeners know just how poor Southeast Asia was, like much poorer than we are now.
Yeah.
And yet there are certain places that have managed to turn around the economies by starting to instill a savings culture. And savings isn't about the actual rand amount that's saved. It's more about the principle of I will save 1% of my income.
Yeah.
And 1% of a wealthy person's income, 1% of a poor person's income, it's the same sort of a kind of a sacrifice. So thinking in sort of percent terms instead of absolute terms, they started where those economies started changing from consume everything to just save a little. That's where you can start to sort of change. And it's something that's in your own control. Very few of the other things we speak about are really within our control. Yeah, we can't decide what America does with its foreign policy or with its monetary policy. And we can't even really influence our own government much, as opposed to every
even
4 years when we vote, right?
Like,
that's about all we can do about
it. Even the government doesn't have that many levers they can pull. I mean,
no, because they're trapped with this debt. They don't have
the Reserve
space
Bank,
to move.
The Reserve Bank has this one crude thing with interest rates. That's all it can do.
There's not much that our government can do in terms of the budget at the moment. The entitlements are there. The dependencies are there. The expectations are there. And there's debt that has to be paid. So as much as we can complain about what's coming, which is going to be more taxes, quite stealthy ones, more often, likely than the more obvious ones. And of course, we have to spend that money. But one of the things we can do for ourselves is to save a little bit, because that's like investing in us for ourselves, right?
Yeah.
And that's something that a government can't stop you from doing. But so, I know it's hard. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's that sort of mindset of investing in our own future and like sort of building a stake in our own future is really important. And the other thing that comes along with saving is very closely linked to the issue of ownership, which I think is the biggest issue here in South Africa.
Yeah,
we are franchised in that we have a vote, but most of our citizens are not franchised in that they do not own any piece of our economy. We have a nation of tenants. People don't own the land that they've built on. They don't own shares in our companies. They don't own stakes in the companies that they work for. I know there's a few.
They don't own their cars.
They don't own our cars. And when you don't own anything, when you don't own any of the land that you live in, you don't own any of the dividends that come from your mineral rights, you don't own any of the companies in your stock market because you don't have access to it. Of course, you're not going to be excited when the economy does start growing, because quite frankly, you're not going to be a part of that. Mm. And the ownership culture can only come from a savings culture, right? I mean, the government can help there a bit too, giving land title deeds, for example. They're great initiatives there, like where with all that property the government owns, the people are built informally upon, or the long in rural areas. We can do that from a property perspective. But or even if you want to get into the expropriation debate, I mean, that's not going to help if it ends up in the hands of the government instead of ending up in the hands of individuals, giving more ownership to more people. But owning pieces of the companies that we support, that's what we just don't have in our mentality, and we don't have in practice. But there are mechanisms, if you want to look at sort of financial technologies, that can allow people to invest fractionally in shares. And
absolutely.
You know, the Easy Equities and the Purple Group people that do that.
And many people
and that
do.
That ownership mentality is something we need to get to, but you can't get to it unless you've got a little bit of savings to get there. So
Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about some of the work that you do, because you will spend a lot of time analyzing data, trying to figure out what the movements in the South African market are. Are there areas of growth at the moment in South Africa? Because a lot of the story so far is pretty depressing. Are there things that are just performing and shooting the lights out right now, or at least showing tiny, tiny amounts of growth?
Oh, well, our agricultural sector isn't doing too badly. We've got pretty good.
As long as we don't,
we've got pretty good natural
resources. As long as we don't expropriate
there.
Farms and murder farmers, we'll be okay. But this is an actual.
But there's a reason why governments across the world are trying to confiscate farms. It's because the things that people actually need, like food and water, are things that always have value, even as we're distracted by artificial intelligence and living intelligence and new technology.
Good point.
Focusing on the stuff that really has value. There's a reason why Bill Gates is buying farms in Africa, because they have actual value, not theoretical, abstracted financial economy value. They have real value in a pinch, right? So we're not doing too badly there at the moment. I'm sure Wandile, who's been talking about all this, there's been quite a few green shoots coming out of our economic data in the agricultural sector. Property market not doing so great, but I do find it interesting that, as we predicted, we're starting to see reverse semigration from the Cape back to Joburg.
Yeah, I saw this. Let me just read the story quickly.
Which I spoke about the beginning of 2 years ago, and people were like, you're absolutely nuts.
So this is interesting.
The one-way migration trend. I'm like, no, the value for money here.
Yeah, and I see it coming up again and again. So this was today in the news that South Africa's semigration trend continues. Surge in homeowners, particularly from Gauteng, who had relocated to the Western Cape. ABSA's latest homeowner sentiment, this is the most recent one, shows a 22.5% year-on-year increase in net migration to the province, with high-income earners driving demand for luxury properties. However, rising costs and a return-to-office culture are prompting some to move back to Gauteng, which remains South Africa's economic hub. We were talking about Joburg and standing up for Joburg earlier, Shildre. Here it is. Despite this, the deteriorating infrastructure and governance issues in Gauteng pose challenges to sustained migration back to the province.
But again, we're creating these problems, especially as business owners, and we're creating these problems because when you look at the traffic, number one, trying to get to work, do you know how much it costs to try and get to work? And now we're talking now we're talking about saving or getting people to save. And yet we're paying them the salaries, but we're expecting them to work in the office. And yet we've got online platforms where people can actually work from. So already there, these are these little kind of costs that all adds up to your average Joe or to the person that is also trying to just make things happen.
Poor people, they spend a vast proportion
on transport
of their total money on transport.
And their time. It's so time consuming as well.
Frankly.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean, you've seen these fly-by-night taxis. We all have.
Yeah.
We were talking about it the other day on the show, that people are posting videos on social media of the worst taxi ride they've ever been on, where the floorboards are gone and you have to hold an umbrella over the hole in the roof when it rains. There's some crazy stuff going on.
So again, for me personally, if companies especially can think about how can we get rid of all these unnecessary costs that our typical entry level employees is having to spend. Let's try and let them work from home, but then train them also around how they need to stay.
But don't you think that the work from home trend is completely reversed now?
It's pretty much done. I mean, the traffic is back and the businesses are calling people back. And there's a counter argument to be had there, that I hear you absolutely on the savings. So when we talk about savings, we can talk about saving our own money, but also saving money for the people who work with us and around us, how can we reduce those costs? But when it comes to working in offices, for disadvantaged people, for first generation people who don't have a network, for young people in particular, the career gains you get from being in an office probably outweigh the transport costs to get there, just because of the invisible opportunities that you'll never know that you miss.
Yep.
And this is why it's impossible to quantify, which means it's often left out of discourse about why we should and why we shouldn't. It's an individual choice. There is a ledger on every business's sort of spreadsheets and every individual's head, what's most valuable to you, the cost, the time, or the opportunities, the progression, the whatever it is. So you got to kind of figure out what your values are. The return to work thing is very much a values-based game, but it seems to be that pretty much most of that is reversed in most of the world, with a little bit of a sort of residual working from home in the sort of luxury Zoom classes still, who are, and they don't know it yet, absolutely in the firing line for the actual AI job apocalypse, which began probably in October last year. And we haven't noticed yet, but
it's coming. Tell me about that.
Like, you know, like analysts have been talking for a long time about AI taking a lot of jobs. I mentioned UBI earlier, but it's happening now, and it's happening in the sort of strata of the economy who felt very, very safe. So if you look at software engineers, that when they were maximally employed was about 3 years ago, and how many jobs have not been refilled or have been lost or have been outright retrenched among really big companies. And we haven't seen it yet because, quite frankly, not a lot of South Africa's economy works in the software engineering space, right? And if you are a software engineer here, you are as rare as a hen's tooth, and you're probably doing just fine. But globally, the sort of idea of let them eat, let them learn code is very much like let them eat cake.
I remember that.
It's really, it's not playing out anymore. You look at how many jobs Meta is letting go. Look how many jobs Salesforce let go. These really big, profitable companies.
Interesting.
This side of the market, these are the guys that are still working from home, by the way, who think that they are very clever, who earn lots of money and have three jobs at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And life's been great for them since COVID. But, you know, like the, you know, nature has a way of evening out, you know, the patterns of inequality and excess. And those of you who have been sitting on taxis every day to get to a minimum wage job, you might feel a little bit of kind of schadenfreude about that.
Yeah.
But the AI job apocalypse is coming. There are a lot of white-collar, well-paid, or as David Graeber would call them, bullshit jobs that will no longer be necessary to a capitalist economy. So these are people that have benefited from capitalism and from how money pools in a capitalist economy quite unfairly towards the FIRE sector of the economy rather than away from the real sector of the economy, you know, the finance and insurers and the people, the middlemen. Yeah. That's what capitalism has done. And people who've worked on that side have benefited unduly and probably unfairly, because you can't really say that someone that's working a full 9-to-5 job is contributing less than someone sitting in an office. You know, these are the excesses of capitalism, but where capitalism works is when it eats its own that have taken too much. And we're starting to see that. And there are going to be a lot of white collar jobs that will be shared. A lot of people are not going to get reemployed after they've been retrenched. A lot of people will have to reskill and probably not learning the next piece of code because AI is going to be able to do that for you. So, and this is starting to happen. We've started to see the signals and it's coming. I don't think it's going to, because of the number of people that work in these FIRE overpaid bullshit jobs in South Africa are very, very few.
Yeah.
It's going to affect your digital nomads living in Cape Town,
right,
as opposed to your friends and family that you that you see around you for the average South African, but globally. We're going to see a bit of a redistribution there. And it's going to cause social unrest because we know that revolutions and evolutions in politics and the economy come from a falling upper middle class, not from the grindingly poor.
We're going to see
some resentment. They call it elite overproduction, where you've got too many overpaid people who think they're entitled to a larger share of the economy. They think they're entitled to their Camps Bay property,
but
right?
That's a bigger
property. That's taken away.
Yeah, yeah.
There's not enough Camps Bay homes for these, for all the
but
people.
That's a much bigger problem for the first world than it is for us.
Yes. But as I said, fortunately, if you look at the distribution of our economy and where people actually work and what kind of jobs people actually have, these are not the jobs I'm talking about.
Yeah. Okay. So quickly to wrap up a couple of, because there's so many things I still wanted to talk to you about, and I see we're out of time already. And by the way, you must watch Biz Trends right here on The Real Network with Biz Community. And Bronwyn is the host. It's an awesome show. You will learn and discover all kinds of things that we don't even have time for on this show. And it will help you to fill in all the gaps that will make sense of what the future is going to look like, what the current trends are and everything else. So don't miss that show. But quickly, while we've got you here, if you were a parent now and you were going to suggest to your kid what they should study or what kind of a first job they should take, are there things that will help them that won't become obsolete, that won't become redundant, that are likely to grow as areas of the economy in any part of the world going forward?
Well, the one thing that you can, that will always be a skill that is investable in, is the ability to learn how to sell. So if your kid is shy, you know, like make them run a lemonade stand, you know, like if you're going to study something, study how to sell and how to hustle.
I love it. This is so basic.
It's really basic. The ability to sell and to persuade. So there's basically two careers that are like certainly going to be cool. If you can sell, you can sell anything. And having worked in corporates and in small businesses, yes, you will pay someone who can sell whatever it is you've got a lot of money to sell whatever you've got. Sure. And that's a function that no one can take away from you. And the other one is the ability to persuade or to orate. And that means that there's going to be a lot of jobs in politics, right? So,
oh, no. You know, like, oh, no.
To lead, to persuade, to guide. So if you want to do that, sure, that's another career path available to a certain type of child. I don't know that I would be recommending many 19-year-olds sit down and spend 4 to 6 years studying really anything mm-hmm. at this point in time, because mm-hmm. so many of those careers, and in fact, most of the ones that are most sort of prestigious, those are the sorts of ones that are the most almost replaceable if you look at the big picture future that we're heading into. So you want Swiss Army knife skills. That's what you should invest large amounts of time in. You should invest small amounts of time in more disposable skills. And bear in mind that pretty much anything you study is going to be disposable. Therefore, make your choices accordingly. Don't invest too much time in that. Invest in whatever skill, whatever is hot for the next 6 months, but do a 2-month diploma on that instead of doing a 3-year degree. I don't go study a 4-year computer science degree. What you learn is going to be redundant at the end of it.
Absolutely.
Rather go and learn, say, agentic AI on a Google course the companies are hiring for right now. Get yourself a 6-month contract and then do that again. That's what a career is going to look like if you're going to play the technology game. Or, as I said, you can invest in those everlasting skills. Whether you were in biblical times or whether you're in today's times, the ability to sell whatever it is, whether it was a donkey back then, whether it's a car now, and that's going to be useful to you.
Obviously, looking after people, because we've got a lot of people in this country who will need to be cared for, fed, clothed, all those sorts of things. Those are not going to go away.
Those things are not going to go away. They're also unlikely to ever be the most well-paid careers.
No, sure.
You know, but they're always going to be steady work. There's always going to be steady work in the ability to sell, the ability to teach, the ability to care. Those sorts of broader category skills are the skills that aren't going to go away. But unfortunately, the reality is ask your mother, you know, like loving your family doesn't pay that well. You get paid in other ways.
Sure. Okay, I love it. Sheldra, it's been a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you so
much. I'm glad that that you got a word in edgewise, because Bronwyn is, I mean, she's just like she is phenomenal. She knows incredible. So much. It's and whenever she sits here with me, I always go, okay, we need more time.
Yeah.
So thank you, Bronwyn. It's always terrific to see you. And you were, as always, a juggernaut, bringing us lots of useful and valuable stuff. And you can make sure that you put Biz Trends TV onto your list of things that you're going to do in the next couple of days. If you haven't liked and subscribed to this podcast, then go and like and subscribe that one. I don't mind. You'll probably learn more from Bronwyn than you will from me anyway. So it's probably a valuable addition to your day. And there are lots of other good shows here on The Real Network that you need to go and pay attention to too. So get onto it. Thank you very much to all of my guests, and we will see you on Friday. Ciao. Thank you.